Welcome to Christ in Every Word, a weekly podcast of the Concordia Bible Institute housed on the campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity every week to read, mark, learn, and take to heart the sacred scriptures with Dr. John Seleska, director of the Concordia Bible Institute, and me, your host and fellow learner, Dr. John Oberdeck, professor of theology here at CUW. We have begun the book of Exodus, the second book of the Bible, a very significant book, and as we learned last time, it's a book that leaves tracks of its theology and its imagery throughout the Bible. John, where would you like to take us today?
Especially in the Old Testament, there are numerous references to the Exodus. And we had thought that perhaps because this is the Christmas season that we might try to weave together the Old and New Testament, predictions in the Old Testament and fulfillment in the New Testament, and how Christ really does measure up to what was said about the Messiah's coming to do for us what obviously we could not do for ourselves, to rescue us. And so we really have in the Old Testament, in the book of Exodus, the idea of an exodus from the land of death. And if we can take this from God's perspective for a moment, it was God who looked down on this broken world since the fall, the awful brokenness and the heartache and the pain, the misery, the shame of it all, and obviously the misshapen and disfigurement of a whole universe of people and material things, that God decided to do something about that, realizing that he himself would have to come and it would take a miracle to put the whole thing back together again. And so he eventually, of course, sends his son. Neither came I of myself, Jesus says, but he sent me. And of course, we'll have God doing the same thing in the book of Exodus with Moses, that he's going to send him to rescue his people out from under that huge burden that they were slaves to the Egyptians and to this Pharaoh who would not let them go. And if they were to be released, if they were to be delivered, it would take someone, in a sense, stepping in, as it did in the New Testament, with the whole universe, to do that job. And, of course, we have the prediction of it, a kind of miniature or a fingerprint in the Old Testament of the rescue from death. Now, let me emphasize that idea a little further with some passages from the Old Testament.
Now, in this way, we are taking the book of Exodus and taking it in a broader context, beyond just the story of what's happening to the children of Israel there in Egypt in their slavery, but what takes place in a larger scale in terms of our own relationship to God.
I guess what we could say is that we'll see God's intent here in the Old Testament in foreshadowing the ultimate final defining event in the New Testament, but he is teaching us something about all of that, and we could look forward to much of it in the New Testament as Christ, having come, insists that he's going to come again. So we have a lot, really, to look at and to study and to evaluate to see how, in fact, from the Old Testament it comes true when he makes his appearance in this world. In effect, it's the eternal God stepping on to this planet in time. It's connecting or linking time and eternity when he comes. And the important thing for us is, as we realize, we are temporal creatures, that really we're going to be connected to the one who is timeless and eternal, which will make us also eternal. And by faith, then, we are really eternal now, which is the wonderful, remarkable story of what happens in the New Testament in the appearance of Christ at Christmas. History really has its origin and its completion in him. And so some Old Testament passages that have to do with this whole idea of God seeing the plight of mankind and deciding to do something about it. In Psalm 68, and it's verse 20, he that is our God is the God of salvation, and unto God the Lord. Now think, first of all, of the triune God. That's Elohim in the Old Testament. And God the Lord, now that's Yahweh, and that would be singular, think Christ. Unto God the Lord belongs the... Now, in the King James, it uses the word issues. But in the Septuagint, it's Exodus. Unto God the Lord belongs the exodus from death. So the broader story is not simply that the Israelites are delivered from Egypt, which is not unimportant as far as they were concerned, but beyond all of that, it's God's intent in that to show us something far, far beyond it. Now, last time I mentioned at least one passage from Hosea. We didn't get to the other ones, but Hosea 11:1, when Israel it was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. And we connected that, of course, if you recall, to Matthew 2:15, where when Joseph and Mary had to flee because of the edict by Herod, had to flee to Egypt, as and then it would be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet, and that's Hosea, out of Egypt have I called my son. But Hosea has a couple of other items to mention here in that connection. In chapter 12, verse 13, by a prophet he brought Israel out of Egypt. Now that word is not unimportant, prophet, in the context of which what we're talking about here in Exodus and Moses. By a prophet the Lord brought Israel out of Egypt, and by a prophet he sustained or preserved them. That's kind of a miniature of course, the prophet who has delivered us. And I pictured it this way last time, but let me do that again for those hearers of ours who have not heard it, that if you can think of Egypt as a land of death, of bondage and slavery under the worst of tyrants, and they could not possibly get out of there themselves. So God would send someone in to do that. And then if you'll think of them coming through that canal in the Red Sea, think of it as a birth canal, the waters then washed away all their enemies. Think baptism. He delivered them, born again, and you can think John 3 and Nicodemus, born of water, but born again under a different leader entirely. Now, it speaks of the Christian life. We, under that old Pharaoh, if you will, the devil, had to be rescued, which in fact is what God has done. And it's why when we describe it like baptism, and it's God, of course, himself in the person of his son who is leading us through the barren wilderness, and he's feeding us, and he's eventually going to bring us into the promised land. So if you can think of that in terms of our salvation, you realize how important the Exodus was in the Old Testament from the land of death. Now, let me quote another passage from Deuteronomy about Moses and quotes the prophet that Moses predicts. And this is Deuteronomy 18:15. We won't go through it all right now, but I want to make reference to it because I said the prophet in this Hosea passage. In Hosea chapter 12, verse 13, by a prophet he brought them out of Egypt, and by a prophet he sustained them. And of course, if you think then, this is how it all happened in the New Testament as we described it to you, through those waters, born again, and we're being led and sustained by, quotes, the prophet that's spoken of in Deuteronomy, and it is describing that prophet in parallel to by comparison to Moses. Now, in verse 15, the Lord thy God shall raise up unto thee a prophet, looking into the future, from the midst of thee, of thy brethren. Now think Christ. He's going to be a real person, a real historical figure, like, of course, Moses in the Old Testament. Listen to him. And now he goes on to make a description, and towards the end of that whole section in Deuteronomy 18, he then says, I'm going to put my words in his mouth. If you can remember in the New Testament, go through the Gospel of John and look for the passages which relate to this. Because in John chapter 1, the people ask John the Baptist, are you the prophet? And then Jesus says to them, and the words which I speak unto you are not mine, but the Father which sent me. corresponding perfectly to that verse in Deuteronomy chapter 18. So you can begin to see the birth of Christ as parallel to the birth of the deliverer now, and we're going to study that chapter 2 of Exodus, because we have the birth of the deliverer given to us there. One more passage in Hosea, and that's chapter 13. It's verse 4 where it says again, it talks about there is no other Savior. That's verse 4 in chapter 13 of Hosea. I'm the Lord your God that brought you from Egypt. You're to have no other gods, no other Savior. There is no other Savior, he's called. And then the Lord calls himself the Savior. Well, we know from the New Testament, there's none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved, except, of course, Christ. And then in chapter 13, I think it's about verse 14, where he says, I will ransom them from the power of the grave. I will redeem them from death. O death, I will be your death. All of that in the context, of course, of this one, my son, who is going to be called out of Egypt. Now, that gives us kind of a background, I guess, or a little bit. It
takes us through the Old Testament passages quite clearly, especially that Deuteronomy passage.
Yeah, that's remarkable, is it not? If you listen to it closely, maybe you want to read some of it there and help our hearers to realize that when this prediction was made, that obviously the New Testament writers, in this case Matthew, which we'll be discussing in terms of Christ's birth and have already in that 2:15 passage, but they know some of these ideas from the Old Testament and look at Christ to see whether or not, in fact, he truly does fulfill the prophet idea here from Deuteronomy chapter 18. But there it talks, of course, about, in that chapter, it talks about those prophets who will come not in my name. In other words, they're going to be false prophets. We are to look for them.
That's verse 20. But the prophet who presumes to speak a word in my name that I have not commanded him to speak, or who speaks in the name of other gods, that same prophet shall die. And if you say in your heart, how may we know the word that the Lord has not spoken? When a prophet speaks the name of the Lord, if the word does not come to pass or come true, that is a word that the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken presumptuously. You need not be afraid of him. Now, what's interesting is that in the, and this had drawn my attention away briefly as when I turned in the Lutheran Study Bible, there's a whole page 307, given over with the title False Prophets Then and Now. And then it gives you a list of people within the last 100 years who have predicted, you know, the end of the world and so forth. Of course, none of that really came to be.
Well, now Jesus also says, you know, and these things have I told you before they come to pass, that when they come to pass, you'll know that I am he. Now, could it be any clearer? He predicts it's going to come to pass, his whole death and resurrection theme, and when it does, and of course that really is the issue, isn't it? I'm going to be the death of death. O death, I will be your death. And so when he rises from the dead, he indicates to us the uniqueness of Christianity. There is no other religion. I realize that's hard for people in our day and age who want to coexist and want all religions to be the same, you know.
Okay, you're talking the bumper sticker.
The bumper sticker,
coexist, which is quite creative, by the way, to put all that together with the symbols. But on the other hand, quite deceptive.
Although it does give us a talking point, does it not?
Because it certainly
really
does.
You can't coexist with false teaching and false prophets. Muhammad, did he defeat death? He did not. Buddha, still dead. All these prophets that you listed there, and I didn't ask you about any of them, but we know about plenty of them, the prophets who made these predictions and they didn't come to pass. We've had one brief, quite, I think, twice now within the past year, who has been wrong in his prediction of the end of the world.
Yes.
And we've had plenty of them before that who have been wrong in making predictions.
And we're only a week away from
from the Mayan calendar.
Yes,
and of course,
let's not forget the Mayan calendar.
Right, and we were thinking of yesterday. It was 12-12-12. That was very unique. I think it's not going to happen like that until 88 years from now when I've forgotten what it's going to be, 111 or something like that.
Yes, we'll get one of those again.
But nevertheless...
In Wisconsin, it was Aaron Rodgers Day because his number was 12.
So
the governor declared it Aaron Rodgers Day.
I wonder
Green Bay Packer quarterback, his number is 12. So.
All right. All right, so that, I think, would take us right to the beginning.
Should we get to the topic then?
To Exodus.
Back to Exodus? Well, no, let's not. Let's take a break first.
Okay. Fine with me.
Let's just take a moment to ask the question that we ask every podcast. What's most valuable in higher education? How do you prioritize all the knowledge to be gained at an institution of higher learning? Concordia University, Wisconsin, located on the shores of Lake Michigan in Mequon, Wisconsin, just north of Milwaukee, is an institution committed to excellence in learning, but at the same time realizes that excellence isn't enough without development and vocation. And what is vocation? You see, we believe God works through our vocations, our callings, those careers and roles we're educated to fulfill in order to meet the needs of our neighbor. The mission statement of Concordia puts it this way: Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ in the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 60 programs offered at Concordia by visiting the website www.cuw.edu. And if you're benefiting from our Christ in Every Word podcast, I encourage you to support this ministry. Mention it to others. Mention it to your friends and family. And then, in order to support the programs that we have here, you can go to our website, www.concordiabible.org, and click on the Contribute page. You'll find several ways in which you can support the message of Christ in Every Word. And now, in just a moment, we'll be back to the topic on hand today, which is Exodus. Welcome back to Christ in Every Word, our weekly podcast. Dr. John Seleska, Dr. John Oberdeck, here we are talking about Exodus.
And Christmas.
And Christmas. How do we bring those two together?
Of course, God looking down on this broken universe and deciding that someone would have to come and put it all back together again. And obviously we know that it was Christ himself who was willing to go. We're going to draw some contrasts also with Moses, who was not quite so willing to go to do what God intended for him to do. He had to have a little prodding now and then, but the Lord eventually was able to persuade him to go back. But we have the birth, first of all, in chapter 2. So if our hearers could turn to Exodus chapter 2, we have the birth of Moses described like this, that a man who was a Levite, and he took a Levite wife, so that you'll realize that Moses then would have been a part of that priesthood, and he would have been able to do the kinds of things that priests would be able to do as soon as all of that would be described in the coming books. We'll go into some of it at least, but not into all the details, but at least we need to realize that he was a Levite, and that these two Levites married and had a child. And he was a goodly child. That's how it's described in the King James, but really a beautiful child. That's what the Hebrew means. I mean, they could tell immediately that this was a special child. Now, I'm not real sure how, on what basis or what characteristics they decided that, but his mother immediately realized that that edict, which we described last time, by Pharaoh to put all the male babies to death, first of all by the midwives and then by everyone, it was really open season on male children. And we thought of this in terms of the devil again, trying to get at that promised seed of the woman in getting at all the male babies here. If he could manage that, of course, he felt, I think, he would be the ruler of the universe instead of the one who would come into this universe, who, in fact, was the ruler. But needless to say, it didn't work in the case of Moses, and we don't know how many other children were put to death, dropped into the Nile River. But it would take an exceedingly cruel, heartless person to even conceive of such an idea. But to carry it through with an edict seems almost unbelievable and yet obviously true, because Amram and Jochebed, the father and mother of Moses, realized that this child, to be saved, would have to be hidden somehow.
And the mother then, she's able to hide the child for 3 months. I think that's rather difficult to do, unless when it talks about Moses being a fine child in the ESV, it uses the word fine in order to describe him. Maybe he slept through the night. Maybe he was not cantankerous. He certainly didn't have colic. He would not have woken the neighbors with his crying. So she was able to hide him for 3 months.
Perhaps both of them sang la 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 louder than the child, so that whenever he started to cry, they got to drown it out with other sounds.
When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank.
Yeah.
So she's got an idea. This is not an abandonment. This is a plot.
Oh, a good plot. And, you know, it's a little arc, interestingly. You almost wonder whether or not Pharaoh's daughter, when she saw this wonder, if she knew that story. I'm sort of devising the idea that she's going to defy an edict. Whether it was her father or not, she was under the edict herself. And when she defies the edict, and draws this child out, calling him Moses because she drew him out of the water, she really is defying her father's order to put all these children to death. And interestingly, the one that's going to be the deliverer survives. I don't know, as I said, how many others were put to death, but that was always the danger for any male child that would be born. And we have the equivalent then in the New Testament, if we're trying to draw them together, that Herod issues that edict to slay all the male babies in Bethlehem and in Vierns in order to get the one.
Yeah.
And so he miscalculates here also, however, with the one here, Moses, who survives.
And the daughter of Pharaoh knows exactly what she's doing, because it says, she took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrew children."
Yeah, she knew he was a Hebrew. Mm-hmm. She must have known the edict. She must have known that they were trying to preserve his life, and that should have been the cue to her as far as the edict was concerned. I'm under that also, and this child should die. Luckily, I found it. I could just drown it immediately, but instead the child weeps, it says. The child cried, and she had compassion on it. And, of course, now then, she decides that it's going to be her child. You can speculate all you want about whether or not she was capable of having other children. Was she married? All those kinds of things just sort of fade into the background in the importance of what happened here, because she wants him to be her child. And then the plan that you mentioned, which is a very interesting plan, works out perfectly.
Yes, yes. Moses' sister happens to be nearby watching to see what's going to happen with the basket.
Yes, it's interesting, and it doesn't say Miriam here. Josephus says it was Miriam, and the only way we know that, we have Miriam mentioned a number of times as the sister, but how that all transpired, we're not sure. There is one other passage, and that's in Numbers, I think, chapter 26, and I'm guessing verse 59, where it says that Jochebed gave birth to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. So we can conclude from that that this was, in fact, that sister who's watching. Mm-hmm. And, of course, she realizes as soon as the daughter of Pharaoh finds Moses, and now it's my turn to interject myself and to offer some assistance. And she says, "Well, do you want me to get a Hebrew nurse for the child?" You know, did the mother mention this? In other words, was this a sort of part of that conspiracy between the two? Well, as soon as she finds the baby, maybe the mother had heard that this was a very sympathetic woman, the daughter, and that she could probably count on her not to throw the child in the Nile River to drown it, but rather to save it. And then when she does so, when she, in fact, does find it, then you step forward and offer my services. But no, tell her who it is. It's going to be the nurse. But this is not unimportant. We don't we have to conclude a lot from what transpires at this point. Because, in fact, then Pharaoh's daughter agrees. The mother takes the child. Her own child will be paid to take care of her own child by Pharaoh's daughter.
Well, the irony is overwhelming isn't it?
It is.
I mean, if Pharaoh knew what was going on here.
If you want to see God at work, in this case, it's so very clear. And this child is going to be preserved because he has important business for him to transact in the future. But now, what happens while this child is with his mother? When finally he becomes of age, it says that she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became the son of Pharaoh's daughter, at least from the daughter's point of view, but not from his point of view. Now, what happened in this time? You know, in it's 23, it's Proverbs 23, verse 6, is it? Train up a child in the way that he shall go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Well, don't you think that she must have told him who he was? That is, his real mother. Don't you suppose she instructed him in the Jewish prospect of a Messiah? Don't you think that somehow she must have indicated to him he's the one who would bring Israel out, because the 400-year period predicted in Genesis 15 at the time of Abraham's dream is now about to take place? Somehow he must have concluded that.
Well, he knew where he had come from. I mean, that's certain.
Yes,
because later on, when we get into this next part, where Moses needs to flee, it's because of his response to seeing an Egyptian beating a Hebrew slave.
Yeah.
And he is so incensed by that that he strikes the Egyptian, kills him, then buries him in the sand. Well, the whole thing comes out later anyway. He thinks he's going to get away with it, but he doesn't.
What do you think? Why is he a Hebrew and not an Egyptian? He's been trained and raised for almost 40 years among the Egyptians. And it doesn't say it here, but it does in the Acts 7 passage where Stephen is reviewing this whole history. He was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, mighty in word and deed, Stephen says about him. So he knew anything and everything that there was to know from an Egyptian's point of view. Still, he was not influenced by that. That's the most fascinating thing to me. And then it says later on, I think it's verse 25 of chapter 7, he supposed, the King James says, that his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them. But they understood not. Now, that's in Acts. It's not here. So somehow or another, this history was carried forward, and Stephen had access to it, and he includes that in his sermon. But that Moses knew this, that he kind of lived that life throughout his early years, and that when he finally did slay that Egyptian who was beating an Israelite, he thought his brethren would have understood that this is part of this deliverance. This is the one who's going to deliver us. Did they talk about that among the Israelites at that time? Did they realize what had happened here? I wonder if Amram and Jochebed didn't say, look, he's here, he's now living in the palace, but he comes back to visit me occasionally because of the early years of contact, and we continue to instruct him and indicate to him who he really is. I mean, all of this is supposition, and yet it makes sense in the light of what Stephen says in that sermon.
Yeah, and yet it still takes a long time before Moses winds up returning as the one who's going to lead the people out. I mean, there's another generational gap in there.
A
considerable amount of time, because once he is accused of being the killer, and Pharaoh is going to try and capture Moses and kill him because of what he's done as a murderer, why then Moses flees to Midian, and then kind of starts a second life.
Totally. A totally different life. He's a shepherd all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Now, you want to think of a parallel in the New Testament.
And this whole period of his life is covered in five verses, yeah. But it's another 40 years, isn't it?
Right. And you know, he must have been a powerful man. It says mighty in word and deed. So up to that point, he must have been a very powerful man because he did this Egyptian in.
Yeah.
Without probably maybe too many human of... what should we say, drawbacks, that he just simply slew him there, and the Hebrews saw that. And they must have realized when they asked that question of him the next day, are you going to slay us the way you did that Egyptian? Yeah.
So he's made it off to Midian. He starts serving there as a shepherd. He gets married, has a child, and we're going to need to leave him in Midian.
Are we?
And yes, and pick him up next time at... where God begins to hear Israel groaning again.
But we aren't going to leave Christ. He has come,
he
has done what was predicted of him, and he's risen from the dead. He lives and reigns, and we're celebrating it this season.
But as for Moses, he's back in Midian.
He's back.
Because that's all the available time we have for Christ in Every Word today. Could you do us the favor of mentioning Christ in Every Word to your family and friends? The Bible Institute, its director and advisory board, are committed to the study of God's Word, and we see the mission of the Institute in terms of helping people come to understand and appreciate the tremendous blessings we have through the Scriptures. So, if you benefit from Christ in Every Word, I encourage you to visit our website, www.concordiabible.org, and there you'll find out about our other programs that we have, and you can even click on the Contribute page if you'd be so able to support our work. Until we meet again, God's blessings be yours